You are listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, episode 114, interview with Bibo Bergeon, director of A Monster in Paris.
Hi, welcome everybody to the Rotoscopers YouTube. My name is Mason, and this is episode 114, the Animation Addicts Podcast. Disney, DreamWorks, Don Bluth, and everything in between. I also forgot to mention Pixar. Sorry, folks, we've had a lot of technical difficulties bringing this amazing interview to you. And so today we have the privilege of interviewing Mr. Bibo Bergeron, who is an industry veteran, and he's also the director of Flushed Away, Shark Tale, and A Monster in Paris. I was trying to think of all the films you've directed.
Can I cut you off?
Uh-huh.
Of course.
And say I'm not the director of Flushed Away. I'm director of The Road to El Dorado, Shark Tale, and Monster in Paris.
That's right. That's right. That was the one I messed up. Okay, that was my bad. I'm so sorry.
I storyboarded on Flushed Away though, and it was fun.
Great. Yeah, but you've worked on a huge variety of animated films, like in multiple departments, and we definitely want to hear more about your kind of varied and wide career in animation. But yeah, mostly we're going to talk a little bit about A Monster in Paris. I saw it yesterday, and I was really impressed. It was super cute. Congratulations on an awesome film. And we want to go into kind of your newer ventures of what you're doing these days. And also, we'll do some general questions about, how you came to be an animator, what it means to you, and kind of the ins and outs of your craft. And so thank you so much for being on the show, Bibo. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And so we are a kind of a multinational, international podcast because Bibo is broadcasting from South France. I'm here in Texas, which is a whole different country, as we all know. And Chelsea is in Arizona. And so we're happy to be connected this way, and hopefully we won't have any more technical problems. Chelsea, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How is everybody here? I'm really glad to be able to be here with Bibo because he and I have been in contact for the last couple of months trying to get this set up. So glad that he was able to fit us into his super busy schedule, and we really appreciate it, Bibo. Thanks to you. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
All right. So
it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to share the history of my craft and my passion. And I obviously you have the same passion for the profession. So the job we will make, and it's great to share it. Great to share it with people of passion.
Absolutely. So. I've just been going over your resume, as it were, on IMDb, and noticed, I guess, all the varied departments and all the varied jobs that you've held over the years in animation. And just to mention a few, just to kind of get our listeners up to date, you've animated for films like Ferngully, We're yes. Back, A Dinosaur Story, which we've done episodes for both of those, so you should definitely go back and watch them and listen to our episodes on them.
Well, you don't have to, especially for We're Back.
Oh, come on. And then you did animation for Goofy Movie. We also did an episode on that. That was one of my favorite episodes that we've done. The Iron Giant.
I love that movie. I really love it. I love working on it, too. It was great to work with Kevin Lima. Was a really, really good person and a good director.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's you know,
trying to get him out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, so that one was super fun, and the animation is so, I don't know, I wouldn't say, yeah, it just seems so lively and fresh, and I feel like the 90s, like, 90s Disney was all about that. And,
yeah.
And then the Iron Giant, that one's definitely made headlines recently with the,
well,
with the theatrical re-release.
I've never worked on the Iron Giant.
Oh, okay.
There is something, I mean, on IMDb, I've noticed that there's some little errors, and the main one being my resume was merged with some other Eric Bergeron's resume.
The infamous Eric Bergeron.
Yeah, from Quebec. You know, he's from he's a French Canadian. I've been sending emails to IMDb and trying to reach this other Eric Bergeron in Canada, but
no
responses.
That's right, because your first name is Eric.
Yeah, it is.
So you have this weird animator doppelganger.
Yeah, and he's working on TV. He's a story artist working on TV, mainly, what do you call that, very young programs.
Yeah. That must be really frustrating. It's kind of a funny, weird story.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it can be confusing. It's confusing me sometimes. Did I work on that?
All right. Well, why don't you set the record straight and let us know, how you came to work in the field of animation and what productions you've worked on.
All right, so do you have the how many hours do you have? I just noticed that I've been working for over 30 years now in animation, so makes me feel old. So I need to take a soup and go to bed now. I didn't want to do animation when I was young. I wanted to draw. That was for sure. I wanted to draw for the rest of my life every day, which I do actually still. I wanted to draw cartoons in the newspapers, you know, it could be doing caricatures of politicians or celebrities, but draw every day about the news. That's what I wanted to do. And I guess I always loved characters. And that's why I wanted to do caricatures, because I really love to create and represent strong characters. And so I went to art school when I was 15, because I already knew that I wanted to do that. So I went to art school in Paris when I was 15 for 3 years, and I had my diploma, and then I get out of the school and I had a diploma for it's called publicity art. And I was looking for another school to keep, you know, perfecting my, you know, that route, and I passed by the Gobelin school, and there are those little leaflets, and in this leaflet there was animation department.
Yeah.
And I've never seen and never knew that there was an animation school in the world. I even didn't know that I could work in animation, or anybody was working in animation, because for me as a kid, I always thought, you know, the cartoons, they were real people, you know, somehow. You never knew that there was, like, you know, puppeteers or animators, you know, giving them lives. It was not even a question in my head. So that suddenly went boom in my head. And then I was working in Paris, and I was 18, and I checked the programs, and the first movie I bumped into in animation in Paris, then there was a re-release of, it was Peter Pan.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went to the theater. I said, okay, I'm going to watch as an animator, just to understand I put my mind into it and try to understand how it works. But the first 2 seconds, click, I was a regular viewer. And and I was like, oh, that's amazing. And, you know, the people flying and, you know, and giving me emotions and you know, you laugh, you cry. And then I went, oh, at the end of the end credits, I went like, oh, crap, I didn't check if it was drawings or not. So I stayed for the next screening. So I saw Peter Pan twice in a row.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, okay. And then it was my mind went just exploded.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my God, this is just a mix of so many art forms. Because suddenly I was like looking at backgrounds, like paintings, and then people dancing, like I was doing, you know, looking at a play or a dance show, and, you know, acting and drawing and everything. And so I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. So I passed the test to enter the school. And then I was in Le Gobelin in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a revelation for me, Le Gobelin. We were like 12 people, 12 young, you know, students, just in a lab, you know, playing with things and trying to understand how it's working and practicing and again.
Right.
And that was really great times. Really great times.
What year was this when you entered Gobelin?
Well, I'm gonna sound very old, like a very.
If you don't mind me asking.
No, it's 1983.
Wow. So it sounds like around this time, it sounds really cool because this program seemed really small and that there was a lot of like experimentation and that you were all kind of growing and discovering together. Like animation obviously had been around for a long time. But
well, and in 83, obviously there was no CG.
Right.
There was not even video, you know, it sounded really like a dinosaur. We were actually developing our line tests on a 16mm negative.
Wow.
And we had those editing machines, and we're using our hands, you know, just to make it, you know, work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can call it old school.
I love old school. In fact, I'm sad that those techniques will probably never be used again just because of how far technology has gone.
Yeah. And it's funny because I'm giving classes now in school in South of France called MOPA,
uh-huh.
Which is a really good, great school. I was talking about that, now it's easier. Technically, everything is easier. And even getting, you will get access to easily to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in animation school in Le Gobelin, we had 2 books. As references, you know, we had the Preston Blair's book and The Illusion of Life.
Right.
And there was our two Bibles, and we didn't have the internet didn't exist. So, you know, to have access to things, we had to go to museums and to libraries, you know, and to bless you and to. You have to go physically to places where you can find references. Nowadays, you just click.
Right.
And you find hundreds of different references. So,
reference images.
Yes. Wow. So, that was different times.
Wow. So how did you get your first gig in animation?
I got out of the school in... with my diploma in 85, and there was Asterix.
Right.
And I was lucky enough because, you know, before that there was not much, you know, work in France, but Lucky enough, there was that production Asterix, and there was a Asterix in Britain, and that was fun because it was in central Paris. There was a lot of people, not only French. Actually, I don't think there were, I think it was more foreign people than French people. There was not enough French animators to do that movie. So there was people from Spain, Hungary, and Canada, and Italy. So that was great. That's melting pot, you know. People really loved that. And I studied as an in-betweener. You know, I was in-betweening, you know, little Asterix drawings and for a month or two. And then I moved on to assistant of two animators. Remember, it was Alain Costa was one of them, French, and a Spanish animator as well, Raul Garcia. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the production, probably the last 5 to 6 months, my animator, Alain, was nice enough to give me some little animation scenes to do. So I was lucky to get some scenes with Asterix and Obelix.
Very cool.
So that was cool.
And now so Asterix is CG animated.
Yeah, well, not during my time. No CG right. at all. So we had to animate, you know, the boat, the ships, you know, the boats. They had to be animated by hand.
Yeah,
that was crazy. You know, the galleons thing, I don't know what you call them. Yeah, great time.
So when you look at your career, what were some of the top 3 points in your career that you think gave you the biggest jump?
Ladies and gentlemen,
what are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
It's always connected to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the job per se, but it's more mm-hmm. like the people. For example, I remember going to in 1989, going to London to work on Five Vulgars West, mm-hmm. and it's when I met Uli Meyer. Who's still one of my best friends. I considered him as a mentor, even I don't think he would like this term, but I was very influenced and inspired by his talent and the person he was and he is. the way, I mean, I was standing behind him and just looking at him drawing, and animating, and was like, wow, that was a source of inspiration. Mm. And I was lucky enough to be in his crew, in his team. So he pushed me, he dragged me up. You know, I was not just like in behind my desk, you know, and just doing my animation. He really pushed me to do the best I could. And because he was so much better than me. So I wanted to be the closest. I don't think I've never reached that level though. But I wanted to, you know, to follow this person. It's like when you do a race, you're on bicycle, you want to follow number one, you know, you don't want to let him go, to give too much distance between the number one and number two. It's okay to be number two as long as you can see number one in the distance.
Right.
Follow him. So there was no competition between us. It was just, it was just a great influence.
Wow.
And Uli animated on Roger Rabbit. He did those beautiful scenes with Dumbo, for instance, you know, getting the peanuts. And that, so, but he did so many things. Check him out and check his work. I'm pretty sure you know him. But he worked with Babbitt, you know, from one of the Nine Old Men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Art Babbitt, and he did so many things, and he got me to work on Fern Gully. If I work on Fern Gully, it's because of him. He has his studio, Uli Meyer studio. So in between the two movies in London, between Five Goes West and We're Back, I worked in London on Fern Gully, and it was fun. Especially I worked on the bat.
Oh, really?
And I thought that was a great character.
He's crazy.
Here's a question that we actually had. I saw from the bonus features of that DVD that they actually do a reunion every so often. Do they still do reunions for Fern Gully?
I've heard of one. It was a reunion in L.A. I couldn't make it though. But I've heard of. I don't know. I don't know if they made. I don't know how many they made. But there was a one reunion I was aware of, yeah. But I wasn't part of it. I didn't work. I mean, it was in between two movies, so I worked probably like, I don't know, 2 months on it, not even. I don't remember precisely, but it was fun. It was fun to work with Uli in his studio. In London, and it was a great experience. What was your question again? Oh yeah, the other moments, the pivotal moments in my career.
Yeah, a turning point.
Yeah. Well, it's when I opened my own studio, Bebo Films, and I got to direct my first commercial. Actually, it's the boss of the head manager of a English studio called Passion Pictures, Andrew Woman, who gave me my first commercial to do was a Heinz, you know, those English beans, beans in cans, well, Heinz, but with the Tiny Toons.
Oh, cool.
And I had to do the whole thing by myself, which was great, you know, to do storyboard and animation, and I got people to help me painting the cells, and it was fun. It was fun to animate, and then the fact that Andrew, you know, trusted me to take the whole thing home in Paris and to do the whole thing, that was great, and it was the first thing I ever directed, so. That's something that comes to mind when I think of it.
Very cool. Wow, the Tiny Toons. It seems like you had already done such a broad range of different animation styles and different like themes and characters. Did you really animate for Babar, or is that the other Eric Bergeron?
No, I did. I did.
Oh, I love Babar.
I did animate like on 3 episodes of Babar. It's when I was working at the Gaumont, which was actually the same building that where the Asterix were made. So I even animated on the pilot for Tintin, the TV series.
Oh, sweet. I love that show.
And,
the old cartoon, they used to play it on Nickelodeon or something when I was really young. And I know it's a lot. I know it's goes back further than that, but man, that was a cool show.
Yeah, it was great. And it was great because the director for that show, Stefan Bernasconi, was my animation teacher when I was in, you know, that youngster in the Gobelin.
Holy cow.
So he was my, and we're still friends. He hasn't changed at all. He's still doing great TV shows It was great. It was great help during school. I was very struggling when I was in Gobelin. I just go back a little, you know, at that period because, for me, it was fun to animate those bouncing balls and and revolving doors and all these other things. But as soon as we got into the soul of a character, I freaked out. I was like, I cannot do that. No, this is too much for me. And I was that close to give up and go like, okay, maybe animation is not for me. I love to draw, but maybe animation is not for me. And Stefan, you know, grabbed me by the collar. He's like, okay, you come back, you sit, I show you how it's done. And he did. And I thank him, to have done that because otherwise, I don't know, I would be, I don't know what I would be.
That is brilliant. And so I noticed that you've worked in animation through the emergence of CG animation. Did you ever get around, did you always stay hand-drawn, or did you experiment or start doing CG animation?
No. The thing is, because of my responsibilities as a director, I couldn't actually animate. I became a feature film director at that pivotal time, you know.
Right.
I was not an animator anymore.
That's right. You went from directing El Dorado, and then four years later they released Shark Tale, which was CG. So yeah. I guess to rephrase my question, like, what was it like, or was it any different directing one film that was hand-drawn and one film that was CG?
But, it's always the same thing, whatever the tool, it's always telling a story. You have to adjust, yeah? You have to, after it becomes only technical.
Right.
So the thing that actually was a little scary, it was when you draw and you paint, for a 2D, a traditional animated movie, it's you pre-think everything. You know what you're doing. You don't, you want to go, right, and you go right. You don't go slightly left or up or down. You just know you're going from A to B. The character is walking there, and the background is there. In the beginning of CG, the possibilities were open more.
Yeah.
And suddenly, I always said it was the devil. For me, CG was the devil because if your mind is not set on what you want to do, on your vision, and the computer could be evil and say, hey, how about this? You can do this too. And how about this? You can go up and down, or you can go bigger, or you can change the focal. You can change the this, and then you can be tempted, just to do all those possibilities and waste your time and your mind on something that's not useful and there's no purpose for the movie. But then that helped me to actually be very clear to the crew about what we should do for the movie and not go too crazy and so trying to put to put the train on the right tracks, and we can have fun in the train. But I was responsible for the train stations.
Right.
And within the trip and in the train, we can have fun and experiment stuff. But that CG thing helped me to have a more structured mind. Because otherwise, the evil computer can make you do stuff you don't want to do.
Computers are evil, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you said, with the technical possibilities of CG, it can be kind of a pitfall or a slippery slope to be distracted by the technology, but also to let the technology drive the vision rather than let your passion drive the vision and just merely use the computer as a tool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You said it better than I did.
I don't know about that. I don't have a cool accent. I'm just kidding. Okay, so speaking of Vision, A Monster in Paris was the first film, if I'm correct, that you directed, but also had a hand in writing.
Yeah, was my third feature film.
Right, that you directed, but did you do some of the writing for the actual story for Monster in Paris, or did you do that for all three of them, Shark Tale and El Dorado?
No, Monster in Paris is, well, you're right. I wrote the story, mm-hmm. The concept of Monster in Paris. I wrote the synopsis, you know, the treatment.
Right.
And then I co-wrote the script.
Wow.
With another writer called Stéphane Casantio.
And it said that it was for your father. Is there a story behind that?
Yes, I remember you asked me that already over the phone, and we both cried. So you want tears again, huh?
Maybe all three of us this time.
Well, it's my father was very proud of this movie. More so than the others. Actually, we wanted me to print some of the images I was doing, and he was putting it, you know, framed it and put it in the living room, which never done before in my entire career. So my father was not that type of expressive person about you know what he loves or not. So it was very kind of little square, and you know, and but for that movie, he really loved it, and he said to me, "I really love it." And then he got sick, and he passed away before, you know, not long before the release of the movie. This is why I dedicated this movie
to him.
Yeah,
that's awesome. So as far as like when you were writing this film, now. I wanted to bring this up again because I just think it's so interesting that you would choose the setting to be during the flood in Paris. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be, one, super interesting that you would choose that. What was the thing that said, let's do the flood?
Why the flood?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I back up a little bit, it's because at first I wanted to do something in Paris because I was so homesick, mm-hmm. and I am Parisian and I love this city. You know, I wanted to do a period movie, and one of my favorite periods are the turn of the century, you know, mm-hmm. the 19th to the 20th century. Because in 20 years, there were so many things happened. You know, in science, in art, you know, there was like, the industry, and all that. So, was very, bubbling, you know, and emerging. A lot of stuff were emerging from those years. And because I wanted to do a monster movie too, and when I found that Flea as a monster, when you write a story about a monster, you have to write as well. The second thing you should write about is like, what's the Achilles heel? You said mm-hmm. that, right? And the Achilles heel of a flea is water.
It's water.
It's water. So, and then I mean, I've read so many books about Paris during between 1890 and 1914. And then I read that flood story. You know, it was the flood of the century, he called it, mm-hmm. and it was a very big one. So like, oh, hang on, so I can set my flea monster story in that, you know, flood. Period, and somehow having the bad guy being the commissioner wanting to use the water to destroy the monster, and you should read the very first script that was totally crazy because actually the commissioner was the one responsible for the flood. He actually flooded Paris just to get rid of the flea. that was silly, and it costed so much money when you budgeted that. There was these machines like these machines that actually is like a mole machine, and that digs tunnels, that in Paris, just to make the subway. So in the first version of the script, there was a bad guy driving that and hitting the metro and hitting towards the Seine, the river, just to flood Paris. I was not Bruckheimer, I was not Steven Spielberg, and I didn't have the budget for that.
Very cool. So one thing that I noticed about Monster in Paris, which I really enjoyed, was just how clean the design communication was for everything. I loved how all the characters had a main color palette that easily kind of set them apart. And then sometimes in animated films, or particularly in CG, like you said, with the technology, since they can go so big and so far with the technology, everything becomes so loud and unclear. The one thing I wanted to compliment you on with the treatment of this film was just how clear and clean everything was, from the cinematography to how you staged things. Of course, staging is really important in animation, but also just how everyone was so ordered, and yet they had their own personalities. And so that was one of the big things that impressed me about the film, was just the amount of visual clarity that I saw. I could totally understand everything that was going on, and that's something that is lacking in some CG productions.
But some of them I've seen like pretty clear to me. But thanks for the compliment. For me, I mean, before I start anything, I'm actually writing the names of the characters. When I was writing the synopsis, I wrote the names of the characters. And even though you don't know Raoul's last name or Emile's last name, I wrote last names, and I wrote how many brothers and sisters they have, and do they still have their parents, and do they like or love their parents, or what happened to them? Do they have pets, and what kind of music they would listen to if they were people from today, and what kind of colors they like, and so I write that ID thing. For me it was part of the create the DNA of a character. So when I write about Foncoeur and Lucille, which are actually the two main characters in the story, they have to really to click and connect. And so I go, all right, so Foncoeur, I'm going to use black, because it's black is scary. People, it's mystery. It's night. It's dark, and night needs light, and light would be Lucille, and Lucille is white, and so Lucille becomes Franco's light, and when Lucille takes Franco in a shelter, she gives Franco a shelter, and they share a room, they share a passion, they share everything. She changed her clothes into white clothes, so it becomes light. It becomes Lucille, it becomes Lucille as well. It becomes Lucille's brother of light, and the one color they share is red. Lucille's hair color and Franco's eyes colors and scarf. For me, red is passion, and so they share the same passion. So this is why they share that same color. So you see, every time I can put words on my decisions of colors and all that, it when I can describe why, the whys of my decision to the crew, it makes it very clear. And people go ahead, they all go ahead, and we're on the same track, and they understand why I did that. It's not, I say that to my students, that don't make a decision just because it's cool or pretty. This is too taboo words for me. If there's not a real reason behind it, like just the ones I talked about, it doesn't make sense to me. There is no something behind it, no history, no emotion. If it's only because it's cool or pretty, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. You know, it's like same for Emil when I pick that particular green, because it goes, it's the same hue, not hue, but if you turn the saturation down, it becomes a gray, and the same gray than the purple from Maud's dress. So they're from the same world, they connect because of that. You know, little stuff like that. Every time I try for instance, the lack of colors, was danger in the story. So, every time, like the end, the fight on the Eiffel Tower is very foggy and there is no contrast because, a setup that the lack of colors is throughout the movie is danger. Huh. And, stuff like that. So, yeah, like I love to think about that stuff before I start anything. You know, I need to because it's a work, it's a teamwork. You know, especially in animation, you deal between with 200 or 400 people throughout the production, so you really have to be clear about your vision as a director. So. There's a lot of homework to do.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So the music was something that was very important to this film. What made you decide to implement the staging of the music the way you did?
Very good question. And actually, the composer and the singer of the French version is called Mathieu Chédid, as known as the letter M. Was my first collaborator on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go back to the previous question. When I wrote my little paper on Francoeur, and I pushed myself to write a tagline, you know, of who he is in one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And Francoeur for me was a child angel. Stuck in a monstrous body, and there was his tagline, and when I wrote that paper on Francoeur, one of Mathieu Chédid's CD was playing, and I remember I saw the cover, and the cover was him, you know, all in pink with his little hair, pointy hair, you know, like a devil, but so he was like a pink devil, which was like. I really love the combination of the two extreme notions, you know. And two extreme notions were the two extreme notions of Francoeur. He's a monster, but he's actually a child. You know, it's a very naive child and in a monstrous body. So, and I listened to Mathieu's music and I was like, well, this is him. I can hear his voice with my designs, and it was really connected. So before I went to back to France from LA, I thought I should meet him. I should meet Mathieu, which I did. And when I met the guy, it was like another revelation. I was like, whoa, his universe, the way he speaks about music and the way he is, you know, he's a romantic rocker. And I really liked who he is, and,
mm-hmm.
and we're still friends. We're still very good friends, we started to. I remember we had our first lunch. I talked for hours about the movie. I pitched it, and 2 weeks after he called me and he said, "Come home, come to my house," and he played the first song. He played the song called The Monster in Paris, you know, when Lucille and Francoeur meet.
Right.
It was age, and he was like, I remember because he was sick. He had that flu, and he said, "Well, I thought of that, you know." And before that, we exchanged some text messages about what the text should be, you know, the lyrics should be for the song, and we play with the words and all about Paris and that how he appeared and his birth was about his birth in Paris, and so he was that child that he discovers the world and people hate him. So there was that emotion. So when he said, okay, I'm going to play it for you. So he grabbed his guitar, his acoustic guitar, and I said, hang on, can we just record it? So he put a mic in front of him, he recorded it. And that take, that was the very first take, I really wanted to put, you know, to put it at the end, on the end credits of my movie. So the song, that version you hear at the end credits, that's Mathieu playing for me the very first, wow. For the very first time, the very first song, Sick with the Flu.
Awesome.
And again, there was another click in my head. I was like, wow, okay. When I heard that, I thought, okay, I made a good move. I made a good move to reach out, you know, to him and to do this movie. I had goosebumps and I was like, okay, that's a beautiful song. And then when I hear that, when I heard that, I was like, okay, Mathieu is my flanker. So everything I wrote from that point on, I thought of Mathieu. Mm-hmm. I wanted to put some of him. Every time I could put some of his personality in the character, I did. Even though what my job is to create unique characters, I wanted to implant some of his personality in the character. And same for Lucille, Vanessa Paradis. Actually, it was when Mathieu asked me, "Who do you want to play for the main female role? Who you want? You know, which talent do you want?" And I said, "I don't know. I need someone who can act, can sing, and some kind of a French icon." And he said, "Well, I'm recording a CD with her, with Vanessa Paradis." Next week, do you want to come over? I said, if I want to come over, yeah, of course, it's a great idea. I pitched the film to her as well, and she said yes. So,
wow.
And what I realized is actually Mathieu and Vanessa are very good friends, and they're more than good friends. They're actually like brother and sister. They're really, the way I see them acting together, you know, and how they make each other's laugh, and they have the really good brotherly connection, and that started me to write in that sense too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that way that Lucille and Funker, they have to become brother and sister, and
right. Yeah, that relationship is definitely evident in the film. So that's really interesting to hear that M and Vanessa were so close in real life.
Yeah, very close. And so that helped, you know, when you start to write about Lucille and some of the scenes, how they meet and what they do, and so that inspired me. You know, the connection they have.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, Matteo, he did the singing voice for Francoeur, and he also, but did he do all the little like flea chirping sounds and stuff too? Did he do like his little voice?
Yeah, we did with the sound designer. We combined with some other things, and we make it sound a little more organic. But he did that little thing that with his mouth.
Cool.
And he has that very high pitch voice.
Right.
He did. It was fun. He came up with, I told him he should be like could be as cute as a little kitten, you know, so it's like
it just kind of have feline quality to that chirping.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Wow, I think that's really, really fascinating. I love it when of course I'm ignorant in things like this, but I don't know. I'm assuming that Matteo Cherid is a big deal in France, and so is Vanessa Paradis. But I don't know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast about how we wish that studios would really think about their voice cast selections for their films, because I feel like getting celebrities or more famous singing voices to be in animated films, it works in some and it doesn't work in others. And so I don't know why that happens, where they get, here in the States, they get Hollywood voice actors to do films, but they just fall flat or they don't work for that role. But in other roles, they work really well. And so I wish I could figure out or unlock the science of how people like animation studios can assign the best voice actor for the job. And it feels like you really did your research and really like looked around to find the right people for this role, because now it totally makes sense how Vanessa and Matteo's relationship in real life translates so beautifully on screen with the two characters.
Because we have created those characters together. It's not like I decide to create characters and then I said, okay, I want a name on the poster, so I pick you. You have to pick an actor for a good reason. The reason, if it's only because it's cool to have that name on the poster and it gets more people in the theaters, why not? That's a production decision. Mm-hmm. As a director, as an author, it's very different on this movie than, for instance, for Shark Tale. Even though for Shark Tale we had an A-class cast,
sure,
and we have created those characters thinking of those people. For Monster in Paris, I spent more time with Matthew and Vanessa creating those characters, much more time in the room, and especially with Matthew. Since the music was such a big part of it, it has to be for the, and I'm torn about between saying you don't need a big star to make a great movie, but at the same time, I've met those big stars and they are great actors.
Sure.
It's not because they're big stars they're only big stars. They're not only big names. If they are big names, it's because they've done good, And because, Will Smith is a great actor, Robert De Niro is a great actor, Angelina Jolie is a great actress. So it's not a good argument to say that it's not great to use those big names because there's other good actors could do the voices. It's true too.
But I agree.
Doesn't mean that a big name is not a good actor. For A Monster in Paris, I think I found my perfect actors for the movie, and then not Will Smith and Angelina Jolie, but they're great actors too, and they were perfect for the roles and perfect for me to build up those personalities together.
Right. So I noticed when I was watching. I watched the English version streaming, and you had Sean Lennon as Francoeur, and then obviously they changed the voices up. But when I saw it, I thought that the English language track synced really well with the animation, almost like it was animated in English in the first place. And so
it was animated in English, yeah.
Oh, it was originally animated in English?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I think that's really interesting. I thought that maybe it would have been an English voiceover with animation.
I wrote the script in French. I had a French cast in mind at first, And then the production wanted us to animate in English, so we can. It's a production reason. So we can, you know, have more an international career for the movie, you know. I had my in mind a French actor first, and then when we made the decision, obviously before animation, to do it in English. So I went, from a search, a hunt of actors that would be great for my characters.
Yeah, and, I think you had a
Francoeur.
Oh, sure. Sorry, go on. I was just going to comment on how much I enjoyed the English cast.
The English cast is great because they are really, they're not big names, but they're great actors.
And they're great.
They've been in, you know, movies and sometimes small movies that I really love. And I enjoyed it. And, but speaking of Francoeur, for Sean Lennon, there was another, lucky coincidence. I talked to Mathieu Chedid, you know, the Francoeur's voice. Mm-hmm. And then I came to him and I said, well, the production wants us to animate on English. We have to, you know, do an English version. And Mathieu is not good in English. He's not good at all. And, he has a horrible accent and obviously he cannot translate his, and the lyrics are very, how do you call that? Sensible, you know, sensible. They make sense, but they're poetic and subtle, you know, very subtle. Mm-hmm. And it plays on words, but it's not like big, you know, it's not vulgar. You know, it's not play on words. It's not a pun, you know, but it's very subtle. Mm-hmm. So, but still, you know, it's tricky to do that in English. So we gave those lyrics to somebody who specialized in translating English to French to English. And it was not good. Mathieu doesn't sound good. And all that. So I bumped into a video. I was looking for, you know, composer, singer, songwriter that could do that. And I bumped into a video of Sean Lennon singing On Again, Off Again, which is a beautiful song. And he was singing that, you know, on YouTube, just him with a guitar, you know, unplugged. Mm-hmm. And I heard that and was like, this is a voice I can hear on Francoeur. And I talked to Mathieu and Mathieu said, oh, he's one of my friends.
Convenient.
Like,
excellent.
What? and he's like, yeah, we did a single together not long ago, and like a couple of years ago. And I was like, really? So yeah, so we can meet him. So went and he took the lyrics. And he did an excellent job. I mean, I cannot stop thanking him because it was very tricky. It was a very tricky job. And he did that just so easily. I mean, it looked so easy for him, but it was great. And the way he sings the song is beautiful. It's beautiful. And
oh, I was just blown away by his voice.
Say what?
I was just blown away by his voice. I loved it.
I love his voice. And when we premiered the film in Paris, we did a special surprise mini concert after the screening. And he came.
Nice.
He came for the concert just to sing with Vanessa Paradis and Mathieu Chedid. So he's a great person. I really love him.
Very cool.
I do like the English cast for Monster in Paris. I like Adam Goldberg as Raoul.
Uh-huh.
And I fell in love with Bob. Is it Balaban?
Yeah. Oh man, he's such a character too in real person.
Right. When I watched Moonrise Kingdom and you know, the Wes Anderson film, and he's kind of the omnipresent narrator for that film, and just the way he delivers his lines and the straight face and the way he delivers there's so much character despite it just being an explanation of what's going to happen in the film, and I just couldn't help but crack up for some reason, but I thought he was a great foil to you know, the boisterous, you know, hard-headed commissioner. And I enjoy.
It was the detective.
Right, the detective.
Yeah, the commissioner was Danny Houston.
Yeah, and I love how I love any story where one of the antagonists turns out to not be so evil after all. Like Pate wasn't really evil. He was just really good at doing his job and very focused on solving problems. And you start to realize that the way Maynard and Pate solve their problems is very different, and it creates a rift there at the end. And Pate, brings Maynard to justice there at the end.
Yeah,
and so I really like a character that has that kind of arc or has that kind of feature to them.
Is the voice and the figure of the justice and the law, you know, and you can tell that he's not a bad person, you know, he serves, what he does is serving, you know, he wants to, you know, things to go to just, you know, he has to be just. And was a great character to develop with Bob, and I love Bob's voice. And by the way, Bob Balaban was in Christopher Guest movie as well. And I don't know if you know Christopher Guest films, like Best in Show and mockumentaries. I'm in love with Christopher Guest work. And Catherine O'Hara was, you know, in that gang, you know, of actors.
Right.
And I picked her for the voice of Carlotta.
Right.
And it was great to hang out with people I really love and respect. You know, for me, they're really great actors. They're not very well known by the, you know, the big audience, but, by the public, but, they're very, very, to me, they're some of my favorite actors.
You mentioned the not well known. I don't know if this contributes to this, but when I saw the film yesterday, I was struck by how real all the characters sounded. They weren't being overly cartoony. They weren't being overly dramatic. There wasn't a lot of screaming involved.
Seemed very organic.
Right.
And thanks.
I felt like when I was hearing Raul, I was hearing someone that I knew myself, someone who is very self-confident, someone who's very experimental, the inventor, the artist. And when I heard Emil, I could really picture someone like Emil. And so I guess another big compliment to this film, Bebo, is how believable the characters are despite it being a CG animated film.
Well, when you write archetypes of, you know, of characters, and but the danger is to write stereotypes or cliched characters. I will see cliched characters in animation a lot because I. They're too broad or too cliched, you know. It's easy to go for the cliché.
You
know.
Right.
Monster in Paris. Since I was the only one in charge of creating those characters, I mean, in charge at first to create that DNA, all those characters you see in Monster in Paris, they're part of me, and some and more than others, and some and part of could be. A brother of mine, or an uncle, or my grandma, or, you know, but there is a friend, but there is trait of character I've seen and I know, but first of all, it's me, you know. Raoul, it's a little bit of me. I can be. I mean, if I was speaking in French with you, I would be joking and, you know. Give you puns that they're so silly. You know, go like, it's just too silly. And Raoul is a little bit like that. He's even that and a few levels more than that. Like I said, when I write a little paper about the characters, Raoul is his tagline was Raoul thinks life is a farce and is the best joker. and his best audience too. So he loves his jokes. And he is the first one to clap, to applaud his joke. That was his trait, you know, one of his traits of character. And same for the others, you know, I can be a little bit of the shy Emil. I can be a little bit of the aggressive commissioner. You know, we have facets, you know, in us, in you, Chelsea, in you, Mason. We can be good, we can be bad, we can be shy, we can be too loud, we can be, you know, we have so many parts, and for me, the Monster in Paris is parts of it, as you know, little seeds I put in each character.
Mm-hmm.
That I guess that's why that makes them a little more authentic, you know.
And it seems like spending time with the voice actors, as you said, to develop the character plays a big part into that. So can you explain a little bit more about your process for developing the animated character with the voice actor? Because I think that's really interesting.
Well, I look at their work a lot. I mean, Adam Goldberg, I've tried to see most of his films, you know, not only in Saving Private Ryan, but what he did in Friends,
mm-hmm.
as
right.
well, but, you know, and smaller movies, and same for Katrina O'Hara and Bob Balaban, which I knew about, you know, their work in Christopher Guest's movie. But I do my researches, you know, to see who they are, you know, what they're best at, and what they convey in the way they move, you know, the way they look at things, and so again, I mean, I try to. I don't want to use an actor as a tag I put on a character, you know, I want to use an actor and to get the best out of them. And same for Madeline Zima,
which I saw
in Californication, and it was funny to use that character as a very Maud is not Madeline Zima in Californication at all.
Yeah,
it's the opposite. But just the way she moves, the way she says things, is particular. That's the thing, is the particularities of the actors I want to use in my characters.
Mm-hmm.
I try to enhance my characters with those little particularities. Same for Adam Goldberg from Jay Harrington, Danny Houston. So, again, homework.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say?
Yeah, homework and research.
Lots of homework. Yeah, homework and research, and those are the keys.
This comes back again and again. One of our favorite animators and directors to talk to is Steve Hickner, who is a story artist at DreamWorks, but he also directed B-Movie, directed Prince of Egypt, and he always stresses the importance of doing your research as an animator and watching not only animation, but watching live-action film to understand live-action actors and the stories in live-action that animation takes a lot of ideas from, or that a lot of literature takes ideas from. In other words, he was saying, if you know classic cinema, then you'll be able to talk to other animators and directors about what you want to accomplish in a film, since we take so much from different aspects of it. And so it seems like you're saying that it's important to do your research and to study cinema and also the cinema of the works of the actors you want to base your performance off of when you're animating.
Yes, I'm saying is exactly that. And actually, it happened to me several times when animators were like taking references from other animation, you know, other animated scenes. And that's a mistake, because the person who animated that scene you take as a reference went through another filter, another work from live action. So first, it's lazy to take a reference as an animator, and it's kind of a stealing, stealing the work somehow. And your animation is not going to be unique or special or because the work you're supposed to do has been done. And so, yeah, I remember on some of the films I worked as a supervising animator, I said, yeah, never take an animation as a reference. The done has been done, and it's not not done for your scene or your character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so take your own reference, hunt for it, search for it, and it's not animation. Not possible. Otherwise, your animation is going to look a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. You know, it's going to look pale. It's going to look pale, and take from the essence. Go to the source.
So looking forward, after Monster in Paris, you are working on a couple other things. What's going on in your life right now?
After Monster in Paris, I've done pretty much commercials.
Mm-hmm.
One for Cartier for Christmas. It was like 2 years ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen it with old CG, with old grooms and little painter, like Christmassy setting. Well, great. So I did other commercials. I just finished one, actually, in December. It's going to be released, and it's a 2-minute-long commercial.
Nice.
I did with the agency Saatchi & Saatchi.
Mm-hmm.
And, Saatchi & Saatchi.
Yeah. From London. And and it's going to be released in March, I think. Yeah, in March. In 2 months or so. But I've been writing a lot.
Yeah.
And I've been developing several feature films. I have helped out some other studios. I work for Marza Animation. Marza, who did the Captain Harlock film.
Oh, yeah. Is that the one that's on... is it called Harlock? I forget the full title, but I think I saw it on Netflix recently.
Yeah. Well, I didn't work on that. I worked on. I helped them developing other projects. So.
Ah.
But my main focus now is to work on the feature film this year. So I cannot reveal yet. But,
of course not.
Are y'all still doing Murphy's Outlaw? It was about these little monsters that make everything wrong.
How do you
happen
know
for
about
you?
That?
Because it's right here. If you Google your name, it says that you're working with Mike DeSave, with Monkey's Uncle, and y'all are doing a movie called Murphy's Outlaw.
Where did you see this?
This is on Cartoon Brew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're developing that with Mike.
Google reveals all.
You don't have to
confirm or deny that it is Murphy's Outlaw. You don't have to confirm or deny anything.
No, Murphy's Outlaw, we're not there yet. We're still working on it. So I'm pretty sure we're not going to start this movie this year. But
I think it's a great concept.
Well, I think so too. And it's great, and great to work with Mike. Mike is a very funny writer, very, very funny. So yeah, it's fun. But the other thing I've done after Monster in Paris is actually I did a live action short, and it was released early last year in festivals. So it did like 10 or 12 different festivals around the world.
It's called Truck. The Four Oz or the Four A's? I don't know how to say it in France.
No, it's called Struck.
Struck. Oh, that's right, Struck. Yeah.
Struck is a short film. It's a 12-minute short film. It's like a surreal romantic comedy. And I really love doing live action. I really love it. I got the bug to do that.
You are going more in. You are doing some live action feature film.
Yeah. All I'm saying is I really love it, and I'm crossing my fingers, but I think my next movie is going to be live action.
Sounds awesome.
Again, it's because I love actors.
To direct.
I really love actors. It doesn't mean that I hate animators now. Of course not.
Sure.
And I'm still going to do animation because this is, you know, this is a passion, you know, mm-hmm. a real passion for animation.
Right.
But I did that short film. I did that the music video for Monster in Paris called La Scène.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first experience as a live action director. I was doing that music video, and I think I caught the bug there. And then when I did commercial, my producer said, who actually was one of my reps. Said, if you want to do live action, you have to do a short first, just to, you know, prove and show people that you can do it. So I wrote that that script for Struck, and she liked it, and she produced it and financed it. So have a look at it. I don't think it's on the internet yet. It's gonna be. I'm gonna send you a copy when I can.
Perfect.
I have to ask your permission.
Yeah, I
don't think it's on the internet yet, because it's still in doing some festival. Last time it was in Spain, like a few weeks ago. So. Probably live action. I'm gonna go for. In the near future, but I'm writing a script for Jim Henson Company, which I love, and I love those people over there, and they trust me to do a live action for a CG film, it takes time because I'm on my own, but it's a great story which I can tell you about, but it's quite adventure. Sorry.
We'll take your word on it. Sounds awesome.
Of course you do. I'm doing some caricature. There's a French TV show called Les Guignols. I don't know if you remember, but during the 80s, there was that English show called Spitting Image. And so it's a puppet show with celebrities and, you know, politicians and all that. So I'm doing caricatures of celebrities for them, which is a dream job for me. It's a small job, but I take it very seriously and with a lot of passion, because that's what I wanted to do when I was 10.
Right. Yeah, your Tumblr is pretty fun to follow, as far as you see all the caricatures that you do.
Thanks, but. That's what I love to do the most, I think, is actually to caricature people. Actually, my very first job when I was 15 was doing caricatures in the bars in France, and to get some pocket money.
Wow.
So I guess I always wanted to do that. So when they offered me the job to do caricatures so they can build those puppets, I was like, oh my God, this is like, I'm 15 again.
Wow. Well, you know, I there's really so much I want to ask you, and we definitely want to have you back on if we ever get to talking about your previous films like El Dorado, which I really enjoyed, and Shark Tale as well. And unfortunately, we're kind of running out of time, and we definitely do want to do the director's commentary for A Monster in Paris. Once we get all this technical stuff figured out, then we want to have you on again, and we can do a commentary that our listeners can turn on and listen to.
Next time, if I go to Texas, maybe we can do it.
If you come down to Texas, we'll have Chelsea come down. I'll make you some Texas barbecue.
We can also come down to Arizona, too.
Arizona.
I've been in Arizona already, and I loved it.
Yeah.
I've been in Phoenix.
Phoenix.
Yeah.
You've never been to Texas, huh?
So what?
Have you ever been to Texas?
No, I've been to New Mexico, not in Texas.
All right. Well, I still need to visit France, so someday I'll come visit.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah.
Well,
be a stranger.
Absolutely. So I guess in closing, we always like to ask our interviewees this, but we do have a lot of listeners who are aspiring animators who want to have the experience of working in the industry and follow their dreams and passions. What is one piece of advice that you learned that was very important to you that you would like to pass on to aspiring animators that listen to us?
Well, it's going to be a bit like not the first time that people are going to hear that, but I have to hammer it. Don't try to be another animator. Just be the animator you are. So don't try to represent somebody that you are not. I've seen too many reels that actually look very similar. So I think try to surprise people. Not second guess what people want. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Second guessing is a poison. It's a poison to creativity. Do your research. See a lot of films. See plays and see people dance and study and. But first of all, I'm gonna say it again. Don't do anything because it's pretty or cool. Put meanings behind everything. Put meanings in every detail. That's my number one thing I would say to an inspiring animator.
Excellent.
Just put some. Don't try to impress anybody. Just put meaning in every little details of your animation.
Thanks for that. I don't know if you know, but I do rigging and character technical direction for CG animation. That's what I'm studying, and I'm also I've also done animated short films for my university. And so hearing that, that's excellent advice to have, because right now I am in the process of showing my reel to studios, trying to get internships and starting to get into jobs once I get out of grad school. And so we really appreciate the advice. And I totally agree. I tend to be a very passionate person about the things that interest me and the art style that I want, that is me as an artist. And sometimes I feel like I fall into the trap of being afraid of my own art style or my own contribution that I can give to animation, and then you can get into the danger of sending in something, like you said, that you think people want to see, but what you're really doing is betraying who you are as an animator.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really great piece of advice, so thanks.
You're welcome. But I really believe that. I really believe that if you give don't start anything thinking, I have to give what people want, because you have no idea what they want. And actually, the people, they have no idea what they want either.
Mm-hmm.
I think the number one thing they want is to get surprised, positively surprised. You know, they want to be attentive, you know, and they want to see something out of this world, marvelous and touching, but you don't know what they want. So the only thing is to be authentic. You know, you have to do something genuine, and that's something from your heart, and something that would surprise them. So a big director told me one day, there is no such a thing as a bad idea. When you put something on the table, you know, if you want to look for the pearl, you know, in the oyster, you have to check all the oysters. Check out, you know, all the oysters. And an oyster looks like a very ugly rock. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like a pearl. So throw out all the ugly rocks you can, and there's probably a pearl in it. That's what that director told me. And that director was Francis Ford Coppola, and with whom I had the chance to work 2 months with as a story artist. And I keep that in mind. Since then, it was in 95, you know, and I still have those words in mind. So it's like, don't be afraid to throw out, you know, everything you have in mind, because there's probably something good, even if it looks like a scent grain. You can polish it, you know, and it can shine. So that's the other thing I would say too. So don't be afraid to give your what it seems like a bad idea, to give it as a present.
Yeah. That's really good advice. We
that
really
makes sense.
Appreciate that. Yeah, it makes total sense. It's a great insight, definitely. Well, unfortunately, we got to bring this to a close. But man, I've really enjoyed talking to you, Bebo, and mm-hmm. it's been a real pleasure meeting you, talking about your very varied resume that you've cleared up for us now. And thank you so much for your commentary on what. You know, your passion that drove you through A Monster in Paris. And we definitely recommend all our listeners to check out that film, because I consider it a work of art, and I was really thrilled to watch it.
Thanks. And so I take that chance. If there's anybody out there working at IMDb, please contact me to fix that thing about my resume being merged with somebody else's resume. So.
Excuse me.
Well, if we have any influence, we'll try to use it to set the record straight with them. All right. Well, hey, thank you so much, Bebo, and we'll let you go, and then Chelsea and I will wrap up the episode. We'll do all our wrapping up stuff in the end here. Well, thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you.
Best of luck to you, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Anytime.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care.
Au revoir.
Well, that was fantastic. I love, he's such a great guy and extremely giving of his time. And we're so grateful for that time that Bebo was able to give for us today.
A little behind the scenes, and you probably got this from my horribly botched opening for this episode, but we were trying for about an hour to get this episode to work, and we were just having so many unlucky technical problems. So.
I know.
I totally flubbed on his directorial credits, and so I feel really bad about that. But I was also really flustered because we were trying to figure out the technical stuff. But as always, we want the interviewee to talk more than us, and we want it to be about him. And so we hope that you all learned something from Bebo and his. It's just amazing how I feel like no one animation professional that we interview is the same. They have such unique stories to tell, and so much great advice, and so much history and experience behind them. And I love that we have the opportunity to do the show, that we can do it live, and that we can share these experiences and these moments that we have with these professionals with mm-hmm. all of you. And of course, without our patron subscribers, we wouldn't even be able to do this on video and have the live broadcast. So. As always, thank you so much to our subscribers, and you can go to rotoscopers.com/patron or /Patreon to learn more about how you can support the show And like I said, it's all because of you that we're able to do these kind of expanded formats on the podcast. And of course, we will have the audio on the website for you to listen to on your commute. It's never good to watch video while you're driving. You're thinking about you too.
Yeah. If you have any questions or if you want to get to the show notes on this, you can go to rotoscopers.com/114. Most of that will be up tomorrow. I probably won't have time to do it right now, but definitely if you are wanting to do anything and like tweet about this on Twitter, you can go to hashtag AnimAddicts or hashtag AnimAddicts114 and make sure to tag Bebo in there. Bebo is fantastic, and that's one of the main things I love being able to follow him for on Twitter too. He's very active there. So you can look up, he is at the at and then LE_BIBO. Le Bebo.
Yep.
So make sure to check him out. Also, if you want to leave us a voicemail, we will be doing our normal scheduled podcast of a movie review coming up. And we do, we are waiting for more voicemails. And so you can catch us at rotoscopers.com/voicemails. And you can also call us at 406-646-6575.
Yeah, this was kind of an impromptu episode. We really want to thank Bebo for giving his time and sacrificing a little chunk of his Saturday. Well, I don't know. Is it Friday night there or Saturday evening?
It's Saturday evening there.
Okay, so like we've taken a huge chunk out of party time for the weekend, and so we just want to thank him again and. What's going to be our next episode? I don't see it on the upcoming episodes.
Yeah, I think it's actually a patron choice. So we'll get back to you and we'll post that later tonight, what the next episode is going to be. So this also
could
one
be
last
anything.
Thing.
It could be anything. Fritz the cat.
It won't be. Okay. It won't be anything, I guess. Make sure iTunes. So make sure you go and subscribe to us on iTunes, and we're also available on Stitcher Radio. But if you decide to leave us a review on iTunes, then we are giving a book, an art book away of your choice. So what's going to happen is if you go in and leave a written review of the podcast on iTunes, or if you update your review during the month of January, we're going to go through and pick, randomize all of the people who do that, and make sure to send us an email with like a screenshot of your update of your email. I'm not your email, but your review. And that way we'll be able to get in touch with you if you win the art book, which, like I said, is any art book of your choice, no matter where you live.
Wow.
So, that's a big deal.
Wow. So I can get like, I should enter this because then maybe I can get like the hardcover Star Wars, The Force Awakens, the art of book.
You could get that. You won't, but you could.
I want the art. What's the most expensive art book on Amazon?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be, it's got to be in print. So as long as it's in print, we're able to get that. So it's not going to be like Art of the Lion King or something like that. So it's sorry. But anything out there that's within reasonable price.
I want the Godfather Family album. It's currently going for $40,000 hardcover.
Okay. Well, we do want to say thank you to HP Hollow, who said that this gave us a 5-star review, and he said it was a gem of a podcast. We also have Joey Tux, who said that it was created by and for Animation Addicts. Yes, we are. I really enjoyed your review, so thank you. And then also Theg 403093, and he said amazing animation assessments. Thank you for your alliterations. Love it. So thank you so much. If you guys want to send us an email with a copy of whatever you end up writing, then we'll be able to get in touch with you and you will be entered in to win that art book. So thank you so much once again. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me Chelsea Robson. Also my website, chelsearobson.com. You can follow Mason on Twitter at Mason SMTX. You can also follow his blog at, thisanimatedlife.blogspot.com.
Oh yeah. I just entered a new semester of grad school. So, some classes like they require you to have like a blog or like a website to put your in progress work so the professors can look at it. Yeah. So you're going to be getting, if you go to my blog, which I've definitely neglected, but yeah, you're going to start seeing a few more class assignments on my blog now, just because I had to do it out of necessity. But I am taking facial modeling and animation from Frederick Park, who literally invented facial animation, like for CG. And so I'll be showing some of my work in progress stuff and the things that I'm going to be submitting to him. So if you want to judge me on my academic performance and see how mediocre an animator I actually am, you can check out my blog.
Totally judge you. Thank you so much for joining us once again. Until next time, I'm Chelsea.
I'm Mason.
And we
are the Rotoscopers.